This week I'm joined by Miles Hollingworth, who is an independent scholar. He is the author of Inventing Socrates, St. Augustine of Hippo, and The Pilgrim City. He's also the founder and series editor of Reading Augustine. In this episode, we discuss his philosophical biography of Ludwig Wittgenstein, simply titled Ludwig Wittgenstein, alongside discussions on God, mysticism, the problems of language, love, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Emetics, gain access to some exclusive content, or simply keep the podcast going indefinitely, then please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Miles Hollingworth, thanks very much for joining us on Emetics Podcast.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
We're going to be discussing a book written by yourself called simply Ludwig Wittgenstein, which people would can imagine is a biography of Wittgenstein, but it's not in the same vein as someone, you know, a biography such as Ray Monk's biography of Wittgenstein, which is and I mean no disrespect to Monk in this, but a straightforward biographical account of Wittgenstein's life. I think in the roughest terms possible, because I was thinking about how to introduce this book, and it's very difficult because the way in which you write and the style in which you write and the fragility of the writing, in the sense of wanting to not damage the legacy of the philosophy while simultaneously possibly damaging the character of Wittgenstein, is extremely original and unique. And so, you know, in the loosest possible terms, I would just state that it's a philosophical biography, a biography that seeks to combine the philosophy of Wittgenstein and the biography of Wittgenstein into this sort of mystical whole, in a way. But other than that, I would just recommend people to read the book. But before we jump in with it, just tell us a little bit about yourself. And I know this was published in 2018 by Oxford University Press, so a little while ago now, but a little bit about yourself and how this book came about.
All right, well, probably the best way to put it is to go back right to two books before it. I wrote a biography of St. Augustine of Hippo, so a famous father of the Catholic Church. And I was young when I wrote that book. I think I was 28 when I started it. And I just wrote it really the only way I knew how, but I had one definite determination. I had a lot of respect for Augustine for various reasons. What came naturally to me when I was setting out to write that biography, and that was really, I'd written one book on Augustine's political ideas, which came out of my PhD dissertation at Durham. And then I went into this biography of Augustine. Obviously, I'd never written a book like that, never written a biography, but it was a big commission from a big publisher. And so I set out on it. And the thing that really very quickly came home to me was that I just wanted to give this guy the fairest possible shake of the hand and defend him. And that was just an instinct at first, which I guess was there because I'd read a lot about him and studied a lot about him, and people seemed to go after him a bit. So I wanted to just defend him, and I felt that that's probably the most that you can do for someone in a book if you're writing about a life in a biography. I also, I guess it comes naturally to me to write in quite an impressionistic way. And I think that's where the big insights start to drop in. I think it's not the classical way of doing it. It's not the style we've become accustomed to, at least in the English language, but it's what came to me naturally. And I was young, you know, when you're young, you do stuff. But anyway, this is the point. This is the reason why I'm telling you this. This is how it relates to Wittgenstein. So I remember when that book, you know, that was a big book. I mean, can you imagine this now? It's Bloomsbury have the rights. Then Oxford University Press, New York, come in. They pay $10,000 for the US rights in the book. And so that all happened. I got it done. I got it finished. And then they wanted some endorsements. And so, you know, they went around, and I can tell you, this will appeal to you, I know, with where you come from, the angle you come from and the hermetics side of things. I mean, they went around the professional academy. No one wanted to touch it. Even people I knew, you know. And eventually, the publisher I had, he was a terrific guy. He took a punt on me as a young guy, Robin Baird Smith. He's still at Bloomsbury, I think. And he was Rowan Williams' publisher. And he said, well, he's moving to Cambridge and this and that, and he's real busy, but what the heck, you know, I'll send it to him. And it turned out that the Rowan Williams absolutely loved it. And, you know, kind of came out and called it the book that Augustine would have wanted to write and all this kind of a thing. And I didn't know what I was going to do next. And it was him. I mean, I'd never met Rowan Williams before. I still actually haven't met Rowan Williams. So it's nice to say this because, you know, he that was a big thing he did, I would say. I mean, I was just a young guy. But he really liked the book, and he told me it was really something different and the book he'd been waiting to read. And then he said, well, what are you going to do next? I said, well, I'm thinking about writing on Wittgenstein. And he said, well, I really hope you do that. I had another book that I wrote in between called Inventing Socrates. And that's really how it came about. I mean, I probably wouldn't have written it without that. You know, often life is like that. I don't think I would have necessarily gone on and written a book on Wittgenstein if he hadn't said, well, I hope you do it. And then you know, I was able to cut the deal with the publisher to do it. And that's how that happened. And that's really the best way to tell the story, I guess, and the best way to cover some ground and some biography about myself. Mm-hmm. When I started writing those books, I was educated at Durham University in the UK. I taught there for a year. Classical and medieval political philosophy and some modern stuff. But then I went into writing these books, and it was the Augustan biography, I guess, that really got things going. But I'd always read Wittgenstein and admired him, like a lot of people do. And I'd always seen him and read him as a big time mystic.
I was going to ask, I mean, you said Augustine held a special place for you. Was Wittgenstein sort of also someone you perhaps have continuously read up until that point?
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, Augustine, I was just so impressed by his Confessions and his bravery, you know, in writing that book. It's almost a phenomenal thing. I don't know if your listeners, how much they know about it, but you know, go back 1600 years. And if you know something about classical language and rhetoric and form back then, to do what he did was way out and far out. And it changed everything. Created a lot of trouble for him down the line, but it certainly set up Christianity, and the Christian God is the personal God, the God who speaks directly to people, which was radical, absolutely radical. I mean, before that, people pray to their gods and so on, but the gods deal, most ancient religions, all ancient religions are municipal religions. They deal with peoples and the destiny of peoples. But this idea that there's a God who's got your personal destiny in his pocket and cares, radical stuff. And that's where the real big mysticism is, I've always thought. And yes, in answer to your question, I could always see that that's where Wittgenstein was. And I could always see that, like Augustine, so in other words, what I'm saying is Augustine took language up and immediately, you know, he was smart enough and he was well trained enough, and I guess he was original enough and brave enough and whatever else it is that makes one do it. But he always saw language as the problem and the trouble and the barrier and all the rest of it. And something that if you get a truth, or at least to get out of you what's in your heart, you're going to have to get through that somehow. And that's going to take a lot of ingenuity. Wittgenstein was someone else who saw that. Mm. You know, really saw it. and then really set about doing it and made a lifestyle out of it. And so to me, the two fell in very naturally with each other. But I get, I mean, I often get asked it because I went from, I wrote the Augustan biography, which is, you know, the really well-known one. Then that book, Inventing Socrates, in between, where I kind of went into the, which is sort of like the theory of my approach to life writing, I guess, and why I do it the way I do it. I tried to lay that out in that book. And then I went to Wittgenstein, and people often, you know, often, I mean, I find it strange that they ask, you haven't asked it, but you know, if you go around the professional academy, they go, oh, why Wittgenstein after Augustan? But yeah, to me, it's natural. It's on the point of mysticism that they fall in with each other.
Yeah, I mean, from what you've written in your books and my the readings I've been doing around this talk, I mean, it seems to ask the question of why Wittgenstein after Augustine would be to adhere to a very adhere to a caricature of Wittgenstein, just as that early student of Russell, and not to take, you know, any consideration for everything that he opened himself to and admitted to and wrote about later on, and the reasons he had such a, you know, peculiar character in a way. You know, the asceticism itself was this sort of self-imposed, you could argue a self-imposed monasticism in relation to something higher. But yes, before we jump in into the deep end of these things, I do have to ask you the hermetics question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who would you pick?
I guess Wittgenstein has to be in there, right?
Okay. It doesn't have to be.
All right. We'll put him in. I think let's put Augustine in there as well. I've been talking about him. And then I've got to have a third one. I'd go for the Russian early 20th century writer, Mikhail Bulgakov. He wrote, don't know if you know about him, but he's famous for one big novel.
Master and the Margarita.
Margarita, yeah. But I really like his short stories. The Diaboliad is terrific. And also The Fatal Eggs is a great story. And I picked up a really nice, actually, little English translation. I was in New York some years ago, and I think I picked it up on one of those like secondhand book stands they have outside Central Park, and I picked it up and I read it. Those two short stories are fantastic. They're so wild and imaginative, and I like Russian literature, and that's a feature of it for me. It's wild, goes places.
Do you see a connection between your interest in Russian literature and that Wittgenstein-Augustinian struggle?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, famously, I don't know how many people know it, but I mean, Wittgenstein, he didn't read much, which shows in his philosophy, and is one of the, I mean that in a good way, you know, it's one of the nicest features of his philosophy is its amateurism. Which may seem like a funny thing to say of, you know, this fated man, but honestly, it's the amateurism, which has, and I say that because that is one of the big things that has been lost as, you know, within the professional academy, in my opinion, inevitably so. You know, once you become professional, whether it's sport or anything, you lose the amateur style, and the amateur style is responsible for some good things. In philosophy, it's responsible for some, you know, really good things, and maybe all the good things, and indeed, you know, because so much of philosophy now is really just the history of philosophy, isn't it? We study philosophy, study the history of it. We apparently know exactly how it all came out because we're lucky to be at this end of it, and they were just living through it, and it's all done in that approach. You know, I can understand why, of course. You know, if you're a professional and you've got students and they're paying money, and you've got to teach them something, and it's all got to line up end to end, and so on. But for sure, something is lost. And, you know, Wittgenstein is read by an awful lot of people. You know, they dip in and out of him because the way he approaches philosophical questions invites that. And I would say it's the amateurism. You know, you can go back to Augustine. I mean, again, you know, Augustine is so famous, but you know, in the time, a lot of his writing would have been considered not good technically. You know, it's Latin. I mean, because he was busting the seams, especially in his Confessions of Spiritual Autobiography, to be that personal in a language which is so formulaic is near to impossible. So he had to break lots of rules, and of course it went on to kind of found a new style and a new way. And of course and we know this is not a new story. I mean, this is what happens in literature. But it's an interesting point. It's always interested me. You get these explosions, and then as we move beyond it, and these things have to be taught, then everything kind of settles down, and we get back into the rules. And oh well, they did it because of this, and it, you know, in the end, we find all they were just following rules. Yeah, that amateurism is an interesting thing to think about. I think about it a lot.
Mm. Do you think? I mean, so as I understand it, sort of, Wittgenstein really just read Frege and Russell, and that he understood that logic, if philosophy is sort of a continuum, and Russell has, you know, outgrown Aristotelian logic, then why bother with Aristotelian logic? You know, this is the new stuff, this is the correct stuff. And these were really the only two thinkers he was reading at the time when he was writing the Tractatus. And then later on, I think it's sort of said that he does spend some time with Plato and Kant finally. But alongside this, you know, as per your biography, it's clear that
one. He also read from Tolstoy. I forgot to get to that to the previous one. So, you know, you're talking about the Russian literature, and he did read some Tolstoy.
Yeah, and I think that leads that's sort of the book that, as if I remember that story correctly, he's somewhere where that's the only book for sale amongst a ton of postcards, and he just keeps rereading it. And that's
it's in World War One. You've done well to remember that. It's a neat little story. It's in World War One, and you know, he's in some kind of a blasted out place. You know, you can imagine some student. I mean, he did a lot of his fighting up in northern Italy around there. So you can imagine some street and everything's shattered, broken glass, and you know, he's desperate for some kind of a book, and it was one of the few books there, and he picked it up. I mean, that's how he lived a lot of his life. You know, it was a physical intelligence, which I made quite a big deal of in the book, which is my own concept, my own way of seeing it. It accounts for a lot of things in these lives, which are called eccentric, like Wittgenstein's. But I don't think that's entirely fair. You know, it's a destiny is how we should see it. Certainly when you come across a book like that.
Do you think there are philosophical reasons, or do you think there are philosophical reasons as to why he wasn't widely read, or do you think it was just his personality that, you know, why would someone such as himself bother? You know, he was already questioning to such an extent at such a young age that why read it when he could just do it?
Yes, I think so. I don't think he meant anything by it. I don't think he meant anything by it, because he was prepared to go to Cambridge, and he could be irascible, and he could be very impatient. Certainly he had a kind of utter confidence from an early age. Again, it's difficult. I mean, how do you really describe what he had? Because it wasn't, you know, things like, if you say someone has this confidence, you know, I don't think he had anything consciously in that way. I don't think he meant anything by anything that he did. But, you know, he was setting, let's put it this way, all the time he was setting his own questions and then setting about answering them. And it's true, he just didn't really have use for the historical approach to philosophy, you know, where someone sets out on an odyssey of reading and attempts to master what's already been done and then do their own thing. So you're right. Basically, I'm saying the same thing as you, which is just that it's impossible to imagine him doing that, which shows us that it was simply not in his nature and not in his personality to do it like that. And he had the knack for jumping in anyway, you know, right at the cutting edge. And that's certainly what he did with Russell. And then the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. So we're sort of already doing the thing that a normal biographer would do, is picking bits of the history and, alluding from them or growing something out from them, which is, it's always difficult at a remove. I mean, it's difficult enough if you actually knew the person. So what I want to really ask you, I mean, as you've written these two biographies in this very elusive style, is what do you consider biography to be?
Yeah, well, I mean, in this Wittgenstein, in your opening words, which were great, spot on. I mean, I could really recognize the book I wrote and what you said. I took on the secret nemesis, the biography's secret nemesis, I guess I would call it, which is that you're taking on a living life, what was a living life, or what is now apparently a dead life. And you are charged with explaining it. That's the traditional task of biography. Because you're putting it into a book, you're going to start somewhere and end somewhere, and the whole thing has to make sense. And that immediately puts a particular bend onto the whole thing. In the case of someone like Wittgenstein, it gets you to thinking. It certainly got me to thinking, because his whole style of life and his philosophy was really making exactly the point against that. Against this idea that progress and advancement in thinking and in philosophy is all going left to right, and that if we find ourselves here today in 2022 at this point on the timeline, then we've got to be doing it better than people who are before us on the timeline, and that's the way things go. And when Wittgenstein was living, that was all heading in the way of going towards a very scientific and analytical way of doing things and breaking things down into atomistic things and analyzing parts and so on and so forth, and using the powerful new tools of logical analysis and mathematics and all of that. Yeah, I mean, it's you're under almost the push to do it that way and to keep doing it that way when you see it like that is really a moral one or an ethical one. Now, Wittgenstein was extremely sensitive to that and disliked that. And that was the, where he would peel apart from people like Russell, who were, you just sort of couldn't understand that aspect of him and that point he was making. It seemed an extreme point to make that takes one nowhere, because surely we're living on Earth and we're charged to live on Earth and we're in human societies and they have problems and they should be solved and so on. And when someone like Wittgenstein makes a point like that, it just seems completely practically useless. So what do I think the task of biography is in relation to all of that? You've got to capture the spirit. You've got to capture the person's spirit. I mentioned Impressionism before, and that always came naturally to me. And that's how I said about it in both those books. So I took the book form, the traditional biography form, extremely seriously, in the sense that I became very aware of its limitations and really saw it only as a series of limitations and as a way of constructing a very strange dead picture of someone. And it was a... it's a strange point to reach, because the book is the book form is the book form, biography is biography. The whole world has its long worn expectations, and then you come along and you say, well, no, I think it's wrong. And I think it produces dead pictures of dead people. And I think the only sense in which we can know someone is in the living sense. Well, that's, that can freak people out. That's quite weird, knowing dead people in the living sense. But I honestly feel that is, certainly that's what I tried to do in both those books. And, you know, do I think that everyone should do it and can do it? No, I don't. I mean, you mentioned Ray Monk in relation to Wittgenstein. I mean, I had, funnily enough, in writing biographies of Augustine and Wittgenstein, I had the same situation twice, which is that Augustine is also famous because he was the subject of, you know, one of the most famous and beautifully and smoothly written and, you know, perceptive and kind of gentle biographies of all time, you know, written by Peter Brown. Tremendous book. I mean, just a masterful book that it was one of the first big kind of popular biographies of an ancient figure, you know, written by a Don, Oxford Don. And that was that, you know, went out to the interested general reader. It was just really set the whole style for that kind of a thing. And then with Wittgenstein, there's Ray Monk, who just, you know, another masterful, huge biography that gives you everything you could want from the traditional biography. And then I had this different idea. But I was able to have that. The point I'm making here too is that it's not one of opposition. I mean, I was able to do what I did because those other books exist and other books exist, which is an important point. I mean, I'm realistic, you know, about that. But it certainly left me open to try what I wanted to try. And I do very much believe in what I'm doing. I do very much. And I mean, I've ridden this horse, you know, since then in that, yeah, no, I do still think it's weird. You know, I do still think those books and that way of going about things is strange when you really get to thinking about it. And when you really get to thinking about how we know people, and how we want to know people.
I guess the primary question when writing this sort of thing is that I can't imagine there's any figure where you could separate their work from themselves. I mean, quite ironically in a way, perhaps Bertrand Russell is one of the few figures who would probably argue that you need to separate his work from himself for it to be some objective thing as he wanted it to be. But in the sense of, you know, Wittgenstein and Augustine, or specifically Wittgenstein, I guess, the immediate struggle in your book is that to write about Wittgenstein in a sense which both separates his work from himself, so keeps the work and him separate, but also keeps the biography you're writing separate, is a task which basically ruins all these three things. So you have a biography which is a bit stale because it's looking at both of these things from afar, and then both of those things aren't really what they are because in reality, in living, Wittgenstein and his work is just Wittgenstein. And so it's quite a common question, I guess, but do you think it's ever possible to separate a philosopher and their work in that way?
No, I don't, because I think that certainly with the kind of philosophy that Wittgenstein was taking up with and dealing with. Wittgenstein, he's quite a particular case because he insisted on inserting himself all the time. You know, I'm not sure how well this is recognized. I mean, I can tell from what you're saying that you've been able to see it yourself. And again, it's what I needed a way to give it to the reader and describe it to the reader. So I came up with this term, physical intelligence. I mean, he does that, you know, so he, and his relationship, say with Russell, was very typical of that. I mean, he would, as far as Russell would see it, would strike up quite absurd positions and hold to them, you know, come what may. And someone like Russell could see no mental reason, you know, for him doing that. It just seemed obtuse. But for Wittgenstein, it actually was a technique. It was a philosophical technique that crossed the mental, physical barrier. So this is kind of a roundabout way of answering your question by just pulling things in, you know, that kind of help us to answer it. I found this to be very significant. I mean, Wittgenstein was someone, and you know, it just to people who know something about him who are listening, it's what I'm saying should ring true. You know, again, it's this ground is covered blithely in comments like eccentric, or you know, he was a funny kind of a guy, and this and that, and willful and whatever. But the point I wanted to get across in my biography is I do believe he knew exactly what he was doing. And that gets fascinating. And yeah, he would actually use his body and think with his body in that way. Because when you think about it, if you are going to take up an absurd position, like, you know, there's a rhinoceros in the room, whatever, it becomes obtuse only because of the mental picture, the, in inverted commas, truth that is apparently all around you, which you are deciding to stand against just because you can, because you're a human being and you can decide to do it, and you can plant your feet and you can move your lips and say something like that, and apparently, you know, everyone else who's there, or everyone else who conceivably could be there in that moment, they're not seeing it. You're the only one. You know, this would bug someone like Russell, because what they find so fascinating about mathematics and the pure theory of mathematics and logic and all of this is precisely that it can produce or tap into this thing that is there, and that anyone else who could be there in that moment could see. I mean, that's the mysticism of numbers, really, the traditional mysticism of numbers, is that it opens out that possibility. And that then becomes the criterion of truth that's used in those ways and systems of thinking. Mm. It's true because, you know, anyone else could come in and see it too. You know, isn't that amazing? And then you have someone like Wittgenstein, and he was doing this all the time. You know, he was all the time, the way he writes, the way he thinks, he's taking up a position that is really a physical position, and he's just standing there and saying it and being perverse and being obtuse. But then up from out of it comes all of this, come new things, which only come because he's prepared to stand there. And that's actually quite weird when you think about it, because it's, you know, you're not taught that that's possible. So again, as I say, this is a really roundabout, a great question, and it's a roundabout way of getting to it, about what we're dealing with when we're dealing with people, or a thinker who was a philosopher, but he was also in a body, you know, and could move around in their body, but then thought, and that took place in their head, or wherever we imagine that takes place, and then that was put into language and went onto the page, where it stays. The ink dries and it stays. Mm-hmm. And then they die, and we're left with the ink that stayed, and then the life, and we've got to try and reconcile it all and decide what really matters and what came from what. I like to think that we always need to preserve the idea that certainly with thinkers who deserve it, and maybe not all of them deserve it, but to me, certainly Augustine is someone who deserves it. Wittgenstein is someone who deserves it, and maybe others. What I mean by that is simply where the life and the thought, where the life and the thought clearly were one thing, and you can't really separate out the two so well. Then you've got to always see the thought as coming from the life. You know, because otherwise that's what becomes too beguiling to actually deal with as just a reader or the biographer who's trying to separate out and write the story. And Wittgenstein's word beguiling, it is too beguiling, because it's simply too beguiling the way that ideas, good ideas, you know, let's say Wittgenstein has an idea or says something and then you know, he's dead and long gone, and millions of other people can read it and instantly see that it's true. True, again, in kind of inverted commas. They can see it too. That's wonderful, but the problem is the consequence of it is that it does then separate that from Wittgenstein. Mm. because the what you're dealing with then is, well, yeah, he saw it, but you know, now I've seen it, and well, you know, let's say he didn't see it and then I saw it, you know. I could, you know, you get into this whole thing, and again, that's meant to be good, because that's what we still regard as truth. I mean, that's in a way, that's the commonsensical understanding of truth that runs through the whole of philosophy and still does today. It's not always put this explicitly in the way that I am, but I'm just doing it this way to help us to answer the questions.
I'm wondering,
you know, it creates a weird situation, doesn't it? Where in a way the I'll let you say what you were going to say, but it creates the weird situation where the life actually becomes dispensable. I mean, now we've got all the stuff that Wittgenstein wrote down and thought, you know, do we need the life? You know, other than for the funny stuff and the anecdotes. And that too was something I was rebelling against in writing the book, because unfortunately that is just how it goes otherwise. You know, it's like, why was he a great person? He was a great person because of all the funny stuff he did and all the bad stuff he did, and, you know, thrashing school students in Austria and all this other stuff. You know, he's thought of as great because of these words, which have since been taken on by other people, and we hardly need the guy anymore. And I try to put the living back in.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of the, you know, the modern Heideggerian position, right? When he famously said Aristotle was born, he lived, and then he died, and we don't need anything else. But I was going to say that it makes me think of a story which I'm sort of fond of, because I think it sort of articulates the struggle regarding this sort of internal mysticism, you know, you call it physical intelligence, of John Henry Newman, when he undertook his famous conversion, and people said, why did you convert? And he would say, secretum meum mihi, right? That this secret belongs to me, as in it's an internal language which I just could never explain to you. It's not really like a secret, but it's like, there is no way I could articulate to you the secret. And I guess maybe the anomaly with Wittgenstein is his lifelong struggle is that he finds his internal mystical secret, and he's, you know, the struggle with the Tractatus is, you know, he brings Russell over for a week and reads it to him line by line. The same with Frank Ramsey. He reads it to him line by line. And yet he can never find anyone. I mean, he's sort of desperate in his search to just find one person who truly understands his own internal vision of things. And that's sort of, it's quite upsetting, I guess, by the end, or quite melancholy that he doesn't really achieve that. But I guess the question would be, why do you think he couldn't just allow it to just be, you know, his own just individual thing, and wanted to share it in a way?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a really good question. It got to me quite a bit too when I was writing the book. The way I put it in the book was that I felt and this started, as I say, as an impression, and I always let the impressions run, because in the way that I write, the impressions rule. I thought, wow, this guy, you know, this guy really had a capacity for love in his heart. And it struck me because not everyone does, or they have it to very widely differing degrees. But I'm pleased to hear you say that. And I'm pleased that, you know, you saw it too, because, you know, I don't know, you know, I just write the book, you know, so I see what I see, and I'm not sure how many other, you can't really know how many other people have seen it too or thought about it. And you know, in the traditional study of Wittgenstein, the focus is on the philosophy and the technical aspects of it. So this ground doesn't get so much covered. But I got that sense, you know, I got it also from, and maybe you did too, even before you get into the story of his life and relationships and so on. I think you can just see it in the philosophy, in the Tractatus. I mean, it's, I really saw that. I thought this guy has a big heart and a deep heart. He could really love someone. That's what I mean by that. He could really love someone. And I think that's a special quality. And I think that's what was behind something that otherwise is a bit strange and needs explanation. You're correct. You spotted it. I mean, you have, because on the one hand, you have someone who is a genius and is brilliant and is doing something totally original. And he knows all of that. He does know all of that. So he knows that he's on his own in that respect. And yet, you know, here he is trying to, you know, desperately, you know, reading it line by line and trying to get someone to join him in that place, which is true. I mean, he was like that in a way his whole life. And I think it did puzzle people. You know, they don't quite expect that of someone like Wittgenstein. You know, you have someone who is so adamant, you know, is the rock of adamant in how he can think when he really gets into it and how he can put things. And yet there is this extreme vulnerability going on, and this extreme desire for love and for the classic and basic things of love, you know, which are to share, which is to find one other person in this huge world and share with them. And he absolutely had that, and I believe that's you know what was going on and why he, you know, he was famously impatient, but on the other hand, he was, you know, as you say, he was patient enough to still do this for a week or whatever with various people, and he was always doing stuff like that. He was always trying to make the connection with someone, you know, with anyone and with some people who seemed like quite odd people to try and do it with. So that's right. You know, you're right. It's something really quite striking about him. And then when it comes to writing about his life and writing about his life in the way that I did and in trying to get across to other people the things about Wittgenstein that I wanted to get across, that was really something. And that actually was something that began to drive the book. You know, it was an impression that, you know, got bigger and bigger. And I think it's possible to really read him and read all his philosophy. I mean, you don't really read Wittgenstein in the traditional way. It's not, he didn't write like that. He presents you with ideas that pretty well can all stand alone. But I think the context for all of it is love and feeling. Because again, love, you know, love and feeling is the enemy of what starts to go on in logic and in mathematics when you really understand those two things, and language, you know, which is they're all the same. And what Wittgenstein famously saw and famously took issue with was that they take care of themselves. They're not loving. And that's how this impression that I received just ran on and on and got bigger and sort of wrapped itself around the whole book, because that's something he saw very early on. And the Tractatus is all about that. It's kind of almost a mockery of it, almost a satire on it, which is that these things take care of themselves. And in order to take care of themselves, they smoke people like cigarettes. They need people. You know, logic, maths, and language needs us. And that's also where it gets quite weird and spooky and very mystical, in my opinion. And you know, if you've come to Wittgenstein out of Augustine and the Christian side of things as I have, then it darn well should get weird and spooky. And that's what starts to happen. You know, they're not loving in that way. And love and feeling becomes, in a way, your only rescue from them. I think that accounts for quite a lot of Wittgenstein and what we start to get from him that's different.
Do you think that's what like a sort of a Wittgensteinian mysticism could be considered, is to somehow struggle to find a way to retrieve from language the thing that it's concealing? The thing that it just sort of, in the same way a biography very quickly sort of washes over the person and gives you this snapshot,
the word love or affection or hope, it's like, yeah, we're hoping, right? But that word, that language is concealing something that's impossible to get at. So Wittgenstein is self-aware enough to know that he's fighting a battle with language which shouldn't really be, which can't ever really be fought with language. And that's what the mysticism is trying to somehow unravel that.
Correct. I mean, he knew that he was fighting a losing battle and that he was going to lose. You know, he knew that he'd embarked on effectively a long suicide and that it was only going to end one way. And, you know, that got to him at times. So there were times where he would live out the life of a professional philosopher. And then, you know, as people know, there were times when he would take himself off to places like Norway and live an extreme isolated form of life and an extreme ascetic form of life and just be done with it for a while. And then he would be pulled back. Yes. Yes, absolutely. His way of seeing it was that it has to begin with us. You know, here we are. We're people. And for some reason, we are forced to get across to each other by language. And the immediate problem is that we can only therefore make or then make sense to each other. We can't make nonsense to each other. We have to make sense to each other. And this is a strange and a cruel imposition. It gets interesting because when you really start to see it like that and can see it like that and go on that journey with Wittgenstein of seeing language as this great problem, you know, between us that we are constantly having to fight and scrap and overcome, then of course it will get you eventually to thinking of, well, why? You know, was there another time? If you're a Christian, you're interested in Christianity, then you know you can go into the Bible and you can read about a time before all of this. So that's one thing. Wittgenstein was aware of all of that. I mean, how I ended up putting it in the book, which I thought was the most helpful way to put it to a reader, you know, following me on the journey through the book. Well, let's put it this way. I mean, how can it be overcome in this world? Can this problem of language be overcome? What's the best that we can do? And the best way I could put it to the reader and did put it to the reader was, I think that language should be always a one-time device seen in that way. And that if seen in that way, you can, one person's soul can tilt and reach across and tilt someone else's soul. And there can be that incredible communication between two people, which there can be. I mean, the other side to this is, well, it's remarkable how well we all do, given what we're up against here in language and logic and sense and all of it. I mean, and people who work, you know, writers and people who work with language and have, you know, done famous and beautiful work with them, you know, they knew about this. They knew about this kind of thing. We talked about the Russian writers. I mean, I think the classic Russian novelists were very aware of this. And they wrote in a much freer idiom. That's just a question of culture. I mean, it's language. I mean, they simply could. It's English is a very precise language. You know, it's no mistake that the whole, you know, the great linguistic turn, you know, took place in England and, you know, Cambridge and involved people like Russell and all of that. It just goes with the English language. It's a bit different in other languages. So I think the best that can be done, and one of the best descriptions, therefore, of the limits of language is that in the the best use of it between two people who really want to communicate to each other, or two people really in love, is that it becomes a one-time device. So it's just the way I think I put it in the book was just, it's like a stick you just prod the other person with. And then what passes between you is supernatural. Not people male. I mean, I've always stood up for the supernatural. That's another thing that I've always done right from the start. That caused some trouble with the Augustan biography. People expect biographers to basically be historians and good boys and girls and abide by the rules of history, in this day and age, at least. But when you come out, and I mean, I said from the start, well, I'll do it, but I'm going to take the supernatural seriously, because Augustine certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll have interesting consequences in the book, you know, and I'd like to try to do that. And then I've carried on doing that. I've always taken it seriously, always used the word supernatural, and meant it, and do mean it. And so I mean exactly what I'm saying to you now. I think that when two people are able to communicate, then something meaningful, then something supernatural has taken place. Because otherwise we really do apparently, you know, live in the world that science can and increasingly does depict for us, which is another whole big part of Wittgenstein and his philosophy, or another whole big aspect and consequence of it, which is that it you know, on the one hand he was and that's his slightly strange position in the history of philosophy. You know, on the one hand, he's apparently behind logical positivism and this whole way of everything getting more and more scientific and a more and more complete picture being formed, and with the idea that the more complete the picture becomes, the more we should conform with it, which is always a funny thing. You know, no one ever quite puts their finger on that, and that's another thing that Wittgenstein got very right, I believe. I mean, I saw this and believed this before I really got into Wittgenstein, and that is something that I saw that he was into too, and that then appealed to me, and Augustine too in his way, even all the way back then. And in the book Inventing Socrates I wrote between those two books, I called it the ethical imperative. And of course, Wittgenstein talks about this all the time when he talks about rule following, mm-hmm. and when he makes funny examples over, you know, what we do when we go through the proof of a simple mathematical theorem, or make out a quadratic equation, or, you know, prove the quadratic formula or something like that. You know, what really goes on here? Or his famous comment about, you know, Bertrand Russell's, you know, great book with Alfred North Whitehead, The Principles of Mathematics, and Wittgenstein said, well, what actually proves that everything in that book is true? You know, is it the Cambridge University Press printing press? You know, as it churns out the copies of the book? As it prints line by line what is in the book? Because from a certain point of view, of course, that machine is doing the same thing that we would do when we read the book, line by line. And we go, ah, yes. And then we go next line, and we go, yes. And then the next line, and, ah, you're right, great. There we are. Wittgenstein noticed a funny thing here. And, or at least he had he back to what I said earlier, he was perverse enough and obtuse enough, and he had the requisite physical intelligence to make something out of this. I mean, it becomes an interesting point, but it's also a ridiculous point. I mean, a lot of people, you know, who would stand up if Wittgenstein hadn't made something out of this, who before would have stood up in a philosophy class and put up their hand and said something like that? I mean, it seems a crazy thing to say, but it's true. It's true. It's really true. You know, just where are we? And this is really the big conclusion and what we've been... It's really the major point of Wittgenstein's philosophy, and it's a point that we've been fingering in everything we've been saying. Just where are we? You know, by this stage of things, you know, we're not talking about the, you know, ancient philosophy. We're talking about now that we're here in the 21st century. Just where are we? You know, where is the place of the human in all this, and what is the role of the human? Because otherwise the whole thing is humming along so well and so automatically. And it's all studied on the basis that it's out there and it's all running and subject to laws and inviolable and all the rest. And the job of the human brain, if it wants to be truthful and good, again, this is what I call the ethical imperative, because, you know, where exactly does that push come from? It's a funny thing, isn't it? And it matters with Wittgenstein, because all the time Wittgenstein stood in that exact place and said, hey, what does push you to read one line of a mathematical theorem and then proceed to the second one and say that, just what goes on there? Russell knew this. I mean, Russell was troubled by this, but he just couldn't face the consequences of it. You know, he used to say things like that. You know, he never was able to answer them. What makes a logical proposition true? But Wittgenstein, you know, I don't know that Wittgenstein ever quite put it that clearly, but that I've always put it that clearly, because I think that's, it should be stated, and because it becomes the right way to understand what he's talking about. He always stood in that exact place and said, well, hey, you don't have to. You don't have to go to the next line of the proof. Because only when you say you don't have to, you realize what a giant ethical imperative you're under, and that, you know, this is some kind of a weird condition of the human condition, that we just feel we have to, because, well, guess what? Well, there are consequences, you know, and I talk about it in the Wittgenstein book a lot, and that's why I call what he was doing a long suicide, and that's why I called in the form that the book took was a kind of intellectual suicide. You know, I decided, well, how can I, because that's the other thing, how which goes right back to the start of what you're talking about. How you know, I'm still tasked with writing a book. I'm going to stand there and I'm still going to write a book. You know, it's going to have two covers and it's going to have these pages. It's going to start somewhere and end somewhere. You know, how is it possible to actually put this stuff across to a reader? How do you explain it? How do you talk about it? One of the best things you can do is to just perform it. Again, that goes back to physical intelligence. You can perform it. So I thought, well, I can have this book about Wittgenstein begin to round on itself and suspect itself and question its motives as a book. And I can then feed Wittgenstein's own thoughts and suspicions about that into the mix and allow it to then accelerate to a point of total destruction, which is where the book ends. I mean, the book destroys itself. This book I wrote about Wittgenstein, that wasn't completely intentional. You know, I felt that if I had created a book that destroys itself, that then Wittgenstein walks out the end of it alive and not dead. And so that's how I went about that, and I went about all of this, writing a book about this man, which combines his philosophy with his life, and which gets over and around, or just busts through, the otherwise insurmountable problems of language and form, book form, biography form, by making always, each time, the ultimate sacrifice. Which kind of is real, because it was a very unusually formed book in a world of usually formed books, you know, that was a risk. But I must say the publisher stuck with it, which was impressive. You know, Oxford University Press stuck with that and went with that. And I'm very grateful to Cynthia Reed. I'll mention her name. She's actually recently retired now, but she was executive editor there and ran their religion list for a long time. And she loved the book, and she helped me to get it to her. I put it in the preface to Concert Pitch. So I'm extremely grateful to her, and she stuck with it, which is, you know, as I describe it to you now, that was quite an unusual stance to take from a traditional press, university press.
Do you consider it a success?
Yes, I do. I do, because all I wanted when I started out, and when I realized that the book would go this way, was to complete it. That's all I wanted. I just wanted to complete it, and then I did want it to be published. Yeah, it was just like that. I just wanted to make it. I mean, it really became everything in that book, you know, no matter how extreme it can sound and appear, when I talk about things like the already happened world and the supernatural, I mean, I'm behind all of it. I absolutely believe it. So that's also what maybe makes it a little bit unusual, because normally, again, normally, certainly with biography or with scholarly writing, the guarantee of truth is the detachment of the author, you know, or the impassion of the author. I don't know how much people think about that, but you know, that's expected, and that's what is taken to make something true. And you're not meant to so much climb into it yourself and you know, let your impressions form and then let them rule and so on. So I when it was done and when it was complete and then when it was published, it to me it was a success. You know, it had happened, and I probably right when I was writing the whole second half of the book, you know, I wasn't sure that would necessarily happen. You know, that it would A, it would get complete, or B, it would be published. Because I you know, it's a very different book. It's totally sincere. I'm behind it, behind everything. Everything I say, I mean. Yeah, it's totally sincere, but I was realistic about where that puts it, you know, in a world of these things that by now, as we said at the start, I think is highly professional and just doesn't have a lot of time for that. You know, it doesn't really have a lot of time for something that's really new. What matters is where things can fit into what's already there. And I was realistic about that. Yeah.
Have you got anything else you're working on at the moment? Anything you're writing at the moment? Or was this somewhat of a full stop?
Yeah, it was when I finished. You could tell that, I guess, when you finished the book, and I meant it to be. I'd worked for, yeah, those three books. I'd worked for about, you know, nearly a decade on those three books. I'd lived on my own most of that time. Quite far away from everything. I was on a mountainside in northern Italy on the Swiss border, and I worked alone. Yeah, pretty well, totally on my own. I mean, in quite an extreme way. So again, I have quite a bit of sympathy for other people like that, and certainly for Wittgenstein, who did that for stretches of time. I understand why. You know, there's some places that you can only get to on your own. When I finished Wittgenstein, yeah, I felt that I'd got to exactly the place I wanted to get to, and there was really nothing left and nothing more to say. But I am working on a book now called The Pure Theory of Religion. And again, you know, kind of like the Wittgenstein book, which I said came about through that just that remark that Rowan Williams made about, well, I hope you do go on and do it then. The Pure Theory of Religion book, I didn't have a big plan for it, but I was back in 2019, I was invited to Lund in Sweden by the president of the European Academy for Religion and Society. They wanted me to come, and they were very interested. They're kind of like a big lobby group in Europe for the promotion of theology. They're trying to make theology more relevant as the powers that be try to squeeze out traditional theology and make the case against it. And, you know, they pinpointed me as someone who had a different way of doing things and had some success with it. Because I also have a book series I run called Reading Augustine, which has been really successful. And they asked me to deliver a lecture that came out of my work, and I called that lecture The Pure Theory of Religion, and it went over pretty well. And Oxford University Press wanted to do one more book, and so that became this book, The Pure Theory of Religion, which is the best way to describe it is it's a step out of the Augustine work and the Wittgenstein work, and I just kind of continue on my own. So I'm not writing about other people, but I'm, you know, coming clean and putting out my own philosophy and my own perspective. You know, what it is, I look at the miracle of Christ's resurrection on the third day, and I use that across a book to develop I call it a pure theory of religion, which would be comparable to the pure theory of mathematics. It's not quite a proof that miracle took place, but it uses that miracle to peel everything open. Again, that's something, I'm not sure if you'll, how much your listeners know, but you know, Wittgenstein took Christ on the cross extremely seriously. And there's some, you know, terrific remarks that he left about that. Very telling remarks about, belief and the position that the believer is really in, or belief's a funny word, the position of someone who's in a deep state of conviction, religious conviction or emotional conviction or a deep state of passion about something. He understood well that puts someone in a quite different relationship to the world than does what I call mental intelligence, you know, which is the apparent capacity of the human brain to think with the physical laws of the universe. That a deep state of emotion can actually draw you out of that. And then when you combine that with human willfulness, which is what separates them from the other animals who operate exclusively by instinct, then you really got something. And Wittgenstein's point always, when he looked at questions like that and questions of religious conviction and those who look at Christ on the cross and are moved, is that, well, if they then act out of that, if they then order their lives accordingly and act according to it, it is possible to attain a perspective on that where we say, well, it's true. I mean, if someone believes in or says they believe in science and then acts accordingly, and someone acts out of their religious conviction and acts accordingly, now what's the difference? Well, we come in and say, well, you know, people come in and say, well, the difference is that, you know, the one is true and the other is not true. But you see, in the way if you set it up like that, then there is no difference. That's interesting. I find that very interesting. And that's really what the pure theory of religion is going to explore. And if you really go into it, and I will, in the way that I'm going to go into it, you do end up splitting the atom, I believe. And you get to a, you can get to a weird place. The way I put it to the press was, you know, I said, I'm not even going to try and write a book that is true. I just want to write a book that's compelling. You know, if I can take the reader along and it is compelling, I mean, even if they don't want to end up where they end up, if it can be compelling, that's enough. I believe that's more important than truth. I really do. In the what I mean by truth is in that, and when I say it like that, is always just the mathematical paradigm of truth. I believe that that's actually just wearing out now anyway. And more and more people are seeing that. I mean, you're seeing it because you're having, you know, the success you're having with what you're doing. It's for real. You know, things are changing for real. I often get asked that, and I certainly got asked that in you know, when I was in Lund, Sweden, and giving that lecture and so on. I mean, we had all the heads of the theological faculties of the major European universities were there, and everyone's scared. You know, everyone feels that something is changing. So it's for real. I often think the professional academy, the way I see it, I think the way I put it to them then, is it's had the lifespan of like a single person.
Mm.
It's interesting because I often, you know, I often sit here, you know, with my wife in the evening, and we look at, you know, our library and all these books, and we say, well, you know, who will write these books now? You know, I just mean like, because I've done things very differently in my books, but I had a great training at Durham University in the United Kingdom, and was really taken through the masters, and I really enjoyed that. I very much enjoy the, you know, the old school craft of scholarship, and I tried to master it, and then I went on and, you know, did my own thing. And just a related point to that, which might interest you, I always, you know, like I said, I started quite young. I wrote the Augustine Brock when I was young. I always wanted to write a young man's book. That's something that I noticed. I don't know whether you noticed that at university. It's a bit of a funny thing. You know, you go to university, it's like the army, and you know, you've got the professors, and they, generally speaking, not always now, but you know, back then a lot of them were men, and they're of a certain age and so on. And so the whole rhythm of the thing and the style of thinking is the style of thinking of a man of a particular age. That's a fact. It really goes like that in the style of writing. So I was always determined to, if I got the chance to write a book as a young man or a big book as a young man, I'd write it as a young man. Because there's some stuff that you only can really do at that age, and there's some stuff you can only feel and think at that age. So that's important. And that goes back to what I'm saying about the academy. It's funny. It's like yeah, it's had the lifespan of like a 75, 80 year old person. And you know, the internet came along, and that kind of fossilized or was already there. And so whoever was the big names at the time were set up as big names, and this whole thing was structured and became very professional very quickly. But now people are dying out and retiring, and then what's going to happen next? And it's interesting how things just change overnight. Often I look at, you know, I look at the great classic works of scholarship and think, you know, who's going to do that again? You know what I mean? It's a funny sort of a thing. You change happens very suddenly. Change like that just happens. It seems to happen overnight. It's a funny thing. It just doesn't sort of have a place anymore. And then what's going to happen? You know, we're staring into a big hole right now. And I think things that you're doing are extremely important, therefore. Because the I don't see it as a bad thing. I see it as a good thing. Thinking goes on, and we just need new things.
Yeah, yeah, completely agree. So I mean, the dreaded question: when do you think your latest book will be available, or is it nowhere close?
No, I mean, I no, it's okay to ask. I mean, it's it could be done in another year. I think it could be done in another year. You know, I'm working pretty hard at it. Some time is opening up. It depends how long it'll be. But it'll probably be, but it could be in another year. And I wouldn't want it to be any more than 2 years. I don't think it's going to be more than 2 years because I'm you know, it's starting to come out quite well and quickly now. And, I will push, you know, I'm going to push hard. I want to basically see how much of it I can get through this year, by the end of this year. So maybe a year, maybe 2 years. I am enjoying it. I mean, I really, you're right. I mean, when I finished the Wittgenstein work and the Wittgenstein book, I was really, at that time, I did not see myself doing anything more. I was really done. And I was happy because I lived on my own for a long time anyway. You know, I wasn't in any kind of a scene or any kind of a system, or I was just working to get the work done and get it to the place I wanted to get it. So I was really at peace, but I'm really enjoying this new work. The stuff we've talked about today, I really care about, and it will be great to get it out in a book, you know, as I say, a solo book, where I just have more freedom.
Wow. Well, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to reading it when it's out.
Thank you.
But that seems like a good place to finish up. This has been very, very enjoyable. So, Miles Hollingworth, thanks very much.
James, thank you very much.